Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Jane Clayson, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The question brewing this week has been, what did the Pope know and when? This after the New York Times revealed internal church documents from two sexual abuse scandals. In Munich, Germany, when the Pope was archbishop there, he was copied on a memo saying that a priest known to have molested children would return to pastoral duties within days of beginning therapy. Pope Benedict, as archbishop, had approved sending him to therapy. The priest was later convicted of molesting children in another parish. And in Wisconsin, church officials knew for decades that a priest there was sexually abusing deaf boys. Wisconsin church officials wrote directly to Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, as the Pope was then called, about the case, but only got a mixed response from his second in command. So what do these cases mean for the Pope and the Catholic Church? With us is John Allen, senior correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter. John, in the German case, when Pope Benedict headed the diocese, church officials said that he was not directly involved in this case, but the paper trail seems to show otherwise. What did he know?
Well, I don't think we know, and I don't think this morning's report tells us. What we now know is that there was a memo describing the situation of Father Peter Hulermann, that's the priest in the German case, who had come into the Pope's diocese from another part of Germany with allegations of sex abuse against him, and nevertheless ended up serving in a parish in Munich where he went on to abuse others, for which he was eventually criminally convicted in 1986. We know that this memo describing Hulermann's situation was copied to the Pope. We know the Pope took part in a meeting, which, among many other things, Hulermann was discussed. But what exactly the Pope understood about all of that, what was in his head at the time, I don't think we know. And in some ways, I think phrasing it at that level is misleading. Because the real question here, Jane, is what the Pope should have known. And at that level, it's clear there was a massive failure, a failure which resulted in allowing Hulermann to go on to abuse other people. That now, I think, is an undeniable aspect of the future Pope's record.
Well, that question, what should he have known, brings me to the question about another priest who was handling this case for the diocese, who apparently remained, quote, personally, exceptionally close, and remained close to the future Pope for years. So how likely would it have been that he would not share significant details with his friend and boss?
Well, there were more than 1,000 priests in the Archdiocese of Munich at the time, and I can tell you from having studied the career of Joseph Ratzinger, that is Pope Benedict, very carefully, but this has always been a guy far more invested in the life of the mind than he is in the nuts and bolts details of administrative work. I mean, most of his friends spend their time talking to him about lofty matters of academic theology, not the personal particulars of priests serving on his watch. So if the issue is it credible to believe that the Pope really didn't know the details of Hulermann's situation? I would say the answer is yes, but I don't think that really is the level at which the conversation should be taking place. The real issue, once again, is ultimately the future Pope is responsible for what happened inside his archdiocese, and what happened was a massive failure to exercise due diligence and to protect people from harm.
Let me turn to the most recent case in the United States in Wisconsin. Because documents there show that three successive archbishops in Wisconsin knew that a priest under their charge was sexually abusing boys, but never reported it to the police. Late in the priest's career, they did write directly to Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, now Pope Benedict. What did he do about it?
Well, we don't know what Cardinal Ratzinger did personally. We know what the response from his office was. I think it's important to point out that by the time this priest's situation was reported to the Vatican in the late 1990s, the guy was suffering from a terminal disease and was basically 4 months away from death. The response of Cardinal Ratzinger's office was that rather than going through a full canonical trial, which probably wouldn't conclude before he died, that he should be suspended and prevented from acting as a priest, which functionally he already was. So, you know, at the level of detail, I'm not sure how damaging that case is to the Vatican. It obviously is enormously damaging to the church, because we're talking about a guy who allegedly committed more than 200 acts of abuse among or inflicted upon very vulnerable hearing-impaired children. The real problem for the Pope is not so much the details of this particular case, it's the overall pattern. The overall pattern is that it would seem that in his own personal approach to this issue over the years, you had the same pattern of kind of neglect and inattention that has emerged about the church writ large. And ultimately, the question that poses for the Pope is, does this damage his moral authority to be able to lead the church out of this mess?
And what do you think?
Well, I think it clearly does, at least in the court of public opinion. I mean, look, when we talk about the sex abuse crisis, this really has always been two interlocking but distinct problems. There's the problem of priests who abused, and then there's the problem of bishops who failed to clean it up. Now, many people would actually give Benedict XVI as Pope fairly high marks on that first issue. I mean, he is the first Pope ever to embrace a zero-tolerance policy with regard to sexual abuse. He is the first Pope ever to discipline a few high-profile Roman priests who were previously thought of as untouchable, the first Pope to meet with victims, the first Pope to break the Vatican's wall of silence. All of that certainly is to his credit. But on the second issue, that is, riding herd on bishops who failed to step in and clean this up when they should have known better, I think most critics would say that's the significant chunk of unfinished business. And these revelations about the Pope get to his ability to resolve that, because I think the question that even fair-minded people have to ask is, can the Pope credibly discipline other bishops for their failures when his own track record doesn't seem to be any better?
What about this letter from 2001 that the Pope's critics point to when he was cardinal that he wrote, instructing bishops to keep cases of sexual abuse secret?
The great irony about that letter now being sort of presented as a smoking gun is that at the time, it was widely hailed as a belated Vatican recognition that it needed to get involved. I mean, you have to remember that prior to 2001, they tended to sort of pass this off as something that had to be dealt with at local levels. That 2001 letter instructed bishops from all over the world to send their case files to Rome so that Rome could get involved in trying to decide what to do about it. And as far as the secrecy thing goes, I mean, what the Vatican insists, and as a technical matter, they're right, is that the secrecy applied only to the church's internal disciplinary procedures. There's actually nothing in that letter that instructs a bishop not to also report these things to the cops or to the civil authorities. I mean, so the problem really isn't the 2001 letter. But in many ways, that letter was an advance on where the Vatican used to be. The problem is that the Catholic Church had a culture of secrecy about these things. That's what the church is in fits and starts right now trying to correct.
But some bishops, John, are saying that that document was widely misunderstood, quote unquote, to mean that the bishops themselves should not go to the police. And at least one of them say that the Vatican was obviously aware of this misinterpretation, suggesting that that may have been Rome's real message.
Well, what I can tell you is, having covered the story when that 2001 letter came out, because you have to remember this was as the scandal was erupting in the United States, and the American bishops were clearly committing themselves to a policy of reporting all these matters to the police, that certainly no one in the United States took that 2001 letter to contradict that policy. The real problem is that prior to 2001, Catholic bishops did not need a legal document from Rome instructing them to cover this stuff up. That simply was the modus operandi of the church at the time. It was the culture of the church at the time. I mean, in some ways, Jane, it would be a lot easier if there were a smoking gun in the Vatican, because then it would be a simple matter of flipping a switch in Rome and everything would be better. But alas, that's not the case. What we had was a culture of secrecy. And of course, fixing a culture is a much more long-term exercise than simply changing a law.
Let me ask you about the price tag of all of these cases. Just in the U.S., the price tag of these scandals is approaching $3 billion. Cases have been declining here, but we are seeing more in Europe and Canada now. So where will that leave the church financially, John?
Well, it has obviously taken an enormous hit. Now, I'm not sure that you're going to see those kinds of astronomic figures in other parts of the world. I mean, part of the problem in places like Ireland and Germany is that many of the institutions, church-run institutions in which people were abused, were also public institutions. That is, they were funded by the government. And, of course, in most countries, it is much more difficult to sue the government than it is to sue a private entity. But in any event, the financial hit here is enormous and still climbing. But I think far deeper than that, most Catholic leaders would say that the most significant hit here has been at the level of the church's moral credibility. I mean, this is, after all, an institution that purports to preach morality to the rest of the world. And when it is seen to be not practicing what it preaches in a kind of spectacular way internally, obviously it makes that preaching much more difficult for people to take seriously.
The moral credibility is one issue. What about basic church attendance? We know about a quarter of all Catholics go to Mass in the U.S., but the figures from Europe are much lower. Where do you see that headed?
Well, in terms of the impact of the sex abuse crisis, I don't think we know yet. What we can say about the United States is that this crisis erupted here almost a decade ago. It was 2002, 2003. And at the time, there were predictions that this would cause a massive drop-off in attendance rates at Mass, in financial contributions to the church, and so on. And to date, most of the empirical data doesn't support that. The levels of church attendance did not go down significantly in the wake of the crisis. Financial giving to the church did not go down significantly. And I think the explanation for that is simply that most Catholics learned long ago to draw a distinction between the bedrock of their faith, which is in God and in the conviction that somehow in this church they encounter Jesus Christ, and the capacities of the human beings who lead the church at any given moment in time. I think they are well aware that those human beings are capable of screwing up, and sometimes screwing up in spectacular fashion, which, of course, is the story of this crisis.
What do you see as the future of Pope Benedict? How much pressure can he withstand?
Well, I mean, if you're asking is, will the Pope have to resign, I think the answer to that is probably not. I mean, as you may know, there are only a handful of cases throughout more than 2,000 years of history in which a Pope has stepped down. The last one was in the early 15th century, and that was sort of down the barrel of a gun. So I don't think that's an especially probable scenario. I think the more realistic trajectory is that his papacy is going to be tied down, if not effectively paralyzed, for some time to come in trying to put out the fires from his own past. And, of course, all of the energy the Vatican is devoting these days to trying to defend the Pope's record is energy that is not being invested in trying to lead the church forward. I think how significant a hit the Pope takes, to some extent, comes down to how effectively the Vatican manages the scrutiny he's under now. I mean, one scenario would be that they simply wait for the next round of bad news and kind of try to muddle through and therefore allow these revelations to come out in drips and drabs. The other scenario would be that they decide to be proactive about it. They commission a team of investigators to pour through every case the Pope handled over his 30-year career in the church, and make all of that a matter of public record on the grounds that it's better for us to get this out and it's better to do it all at once. That, I think, would be the more responsible way of handling it. Whether that's actually what's going to happen, I think, remains to be seen.
John Allen, thank you very much for your time and perspective.
You're welcome, Jean.
John Allen is senior correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter and author of The Rise of Benedict XVI. Just ahead, with health care reform passed, lawmakers head home, and some go home to tough re-election campaigns, which are well underway, and it's only March. That's next, back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. As The Hill newspaper on Capitol Hill points out, political momentum has shifted so fast over the last week, with health care reform passing, that it's given Republicans whiplash. What's unknown is whether the most sweeping domestic policy reform in decades will be a boon or a bust for Democrats who supported it or Republicans who did not. Lawmakers who are heading home to campaign for the next 2 weeks will all be trying to read the tea leaves, because anti-healthcare reform Tea Party activists are mobilizing to take down even big-name politicians. They'll be rallying in the district of Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid of Nevada tomorrow. He's in a tough re-election race. Sarah Palin will headline that event. Today she campaigns in Arizona with John McCain for the first time since they tried to win the White House. Our next guest is going to be watching. Jeff Zeleny covers politics for The New York Times. Welcome, Jeff.
Thank you.
How fast are the political winds shifting, do you think?
The winds will be shifting a lot between now and November. The rhetoric from healthcare is certainly being felt considerably out in the country in all of these races, but I'm not sure we yet know how this is going to settle down. Both sides are still explaining healthcare. I wouldn't put too much stock in any public opinion polls right now saying what people think of healthcare reform, because people are still absorbing it. People are learning about it. So the shift, I believe, will come gradually over the next some 7 months.
Polls aside, even lawmakers suggest there's tremendous vulnerability in both parties. It seems the heavy hitters in Washington are even in trouble. How so? Why?
No question. I mean, if you look at the Senate races that will be the most interesting, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid certainly tops that list. He's from Nevada. He should have an easy path to reelection. But oftentimes this doesn't happen. He is campaigning furiously, more than he ever has for any other race. He has in mind what happened in 2004 to Tom Daschle, the Senate leader from South Dakota who was unseated. Senator Reid is viewed as the person who got health care reform through. Of course, a lot of credit has been given to President Obama and Speaker Pelosi, but without that 60th vote, without the Christmas Eve debate on health care, this wouldn't have happened. So he has a bullseye on his back, if you will, and he has a variety of candidates running against him, and that perhaps is one of the best things he has going for him. The opposition right now, all these loud voices, have yet to unify and coalesce against one challenging opponent, and that could be a bright light for some of these incumbents who are in trouble.
And certainly Harry Reid is not alone. Another heavy hitter, John McCain, is facing a challenge from the right, from former congressman and conservative talk radio host J.D. Hayworth. He says John McCain is too moderate for Arizona Republicans. Is he?
I was at a campaign event on a Thursday evening with J.D. Hayworth, and I was struck by the level of animosity towards Senator McCain. Senator McCain, every time reelection comes around, always faces a little bit of an issue with Arizona voters. He's viewed as more of a national senator. He doesn't spend as much time in Arizona. His issues have been national issues, and now this is really coming to potentially hurt him. The level of anger, the level of animosity over immigration, over a whole variety of things, was very strong. And former Congressman J.D. Hayworth, who's been a radio talk show host for the last 4 or 5 years, is tapping into a lot of this anger in the electorate that John McCain is quite concerned about. So what does he do? He calls on Sarah Palin, his former Republican running mate. These two have not spoken. They've barely spoken, I'm told, in the last 17 months, only a handful of times. But she has agreed to campaign at his side. She is going to give the message that, look, Senator McCain is conservative enough. We need him in Washington to challenge President Obama. But one voter I talked to on Thursday evening said, John McCain had his time to take out President Obama. He didn't do it. We blame John McCain for President Obama. And he said he's not voting for him, regardless of Sarah Palin's visit.
I'm curious, beyond Sarah Palin, the grassroots conservative movements. You say in your piece today in the New York Times, Jeff, that there are many Republicans in Washington who are wondering if conservatives across this country, conservatives like, for example, Senator Robert Bennett of Utah, is not conservative enough. And if he's not conservative enough, who is?
No question that some of these election results have been watched very carefully in Washington. Senator Bennett, for example, running for his fourth term, conservative by most every measure, is quite vulnerable this year because of a couple votes he's made. Supporting the bank bailout really has become a big problem in the eyes of some conservatives. Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson, a year ago, it was widely assumed that she would win the Republican nomination for the governor of Texas. She lost big. She was viewed as being a problem from Washington. So the anti-incumbency mood is very strong on both sides, but Republicans are not immune to this. So across the country, incumbents, Republicans and Democrats alike, are watching a lot of these to see if this grassroots anger really can unify itself and coalesce behind a single opposition. It's a lot of loud voices right now. But boy, these primaries in the next coming months are going to offer a pretty good indication of things to come in November.
Let me ask you more about tone, Jeff, because you're out on the road. There's been so much anger at Washington and in Washington. What are you seeing out there and hearing among voters?
You know, there is anger and there is frustration. We hear a lot on the news about threats being made to lawmakers and obscenities being hurled. I don't see a lot of that. When you talk to voters, they are just upset. They're upset about the size of government. They're upset about the scope of government. They feel powerless. So I think some people may be surprised by going to some of these conservative rallies or Tea Party movement rallies. Now, these are friends and neighbors. These are not hugely angry events. People are frustrated. But the Tea Party movement leaders, to the extent that there are leaders of a sort of a fractious group, are trying to bring down the volume a little bit to increase the irrelevance. They know if they're screaming so loud, they won't be taken seriously. But boy, they are being taken seriously by these incumbent Republican politicians, because they know that they are potentially in trouble as much as the Democrats this year.
Jeff Zeleny, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jeff Zeleny covers politics for The New York Times. Still ahead today, bringing back the heady days of the dot-com era. News is next. I'm Jane Clayson, here and now. It poured rain in Haiti yesterday, exposing tens of thousands of homeless people to unsanitary conditions and disease. More rain is expected this weekend, but so is more help. Medical teams from the U.S. have been traveling to Haiti to treat victims. And for many of the doctors and nurses, it's a first-time trip, and they're not fully prepared for what they'll find there. Here in Now's Sasha Pfeiffer has this story about how Children's Hospital in Boston is helping the new teams get ready.
Okay, your blood pressure is going to come up on the monitor. Anytime you take
a half dozen doctors and nurses are crowded in a chaotic operating room. A patient is bleeding from her mouth and nose. There's a deep gash in her abdomen, and her right leg is mangled. The knee twisted, the foot cocked unnaturally to the side. The room is filled with moaning. Help me, help me, help me. I can't feel my leg. Am I dying? The doctors work as fast as they can, but they don't have basic supplies or enough personnel.
Let's notify the surgeons also.
Is there a surgeon here?
Is there a surgeon around?
No surgeon.
Can we get some oxygen? Do we have oxygen?
Then things take a turn for the worse.
She's vomiting.
Don't be too alarmed. The noises you're hearing are made by a nurse who's a pretty good actress. And the patient on the table is actually a mannequin. Because most of these medical workers are leaving soon to do volunteer work in Haiti, this simulation is meant to prepare them. Dr. Peter Weinstock, who runs this exercise for Children's Hospital, talks with them later about what went right and what went wrong.
When you turned her, she said something that sounded like my tummy, and she was actually saying, I'm falling.
Oh, I thought she was saying my tummy.
Yeah, it sounded that way. And it just raises that issue again to try and use translators as best you can, or also realize that some of the things you're hearing may sound like certain things, but may end up being very different.
Tyler Hartman was part of the simulation, which is a new pilot program. He's a pediatrician at Children's, and he says the unfamiliar environment was difficult.
Not knowing where everything is, not knowing who the people were, was extremely stressful because I'm used to knowing who can do what and relying on those people to do those things, and not knowing who can do what, I just felt like you could tee up for a worse stressful situation.
But that's exactly the kind of situation he could find himself in daily when he goes to Haiti next month. Most of the medical workers there won't know each other. Some things they may not expect to have, like internet access, might actually be available. But Dr. Weinstock says other basic supplies will be hard to come by.
Things like proper-sized NG tubes, having enough syringes, things around stabilization of fractures, the kind of stuff that we pull right off the shelf.
So the simulation program teaches them to be resourceful, to make neck braces out of rolled-up towels, to make oxygen masks out of plastic water bottles, to bring headlamps so they can do procedures without having to hold a flashlight.
We work in this environment where we would never fathom reaching for a cardboard box and putting a child in it. One of our goals was to really just open their eyes to that concept, that that may very well be the resources that are available to you.
It also teaches them to recognize illnesses that have been wiped out in the U.S. One of the simulations, based on a real case in Haiti, involves a mannequin baby suffering from what looks like epileptic seizures. the newborn actually has tetanus caused by what doctors call dirty umby. That means its umbilical cord was cut with an unsterile instrument. Megan Week is a nurse at Children's. She says the simulation made her feel better and worse about her trip.
Better because I feel like we have a really good team going down and we'll be able to work well together. Worse because it's not like Children's where we can send them to the next floor or, you know, put them on monitors and monitor them.
The program also reminds emergency workers that if they get sick or dehydrated, they'll need medical resources meant for earthquake victims. So they're told to bring mosquito netting and powerful insect repellent to avoid dengue fever. Dr. Weinstock says these little things can make a big difference.
The hope of this program is not to have them hit the ground running, per se, but have them hit the ground walking a little faster.
They're also advised that instead of acting immediately in a medical emergency, take 10 seconds to figure out who has what skills, because that could save 10 minutes down the line, Weinstock says. And in Haiti, every minute counts.
79 over 49.
That's Here and Now's Sasha Pfeiffer. To see photos of the medical simulation exercise at Children's Hospital, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Coming up, remember the heydays of Napster? Ever wonder where its founder is now? We'll find out. It's Here and Now. Remember back in the 1990s when all you needed was an idea and a web address and investors would throw millions of dollars at you? That atmosphere helped fuel the dot-com bubble and push the NASDAQ Technology Exchange over the 5,000 mark. But then the bubble burst. Internet millionaires went broke and the NASDAQ has never recovered, hovering today around the 2,500 mark. This month, Wired magazine is taking a look back at the dot-com boom and bust. Stephen Leckard is a writer at Wired. He joins us now from the studios of KQED in San Francisco with more. Welcome, Stephen.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Let's go through some of the companies and some of the people from the dot-com era. One of your favorites in your article is Josh Harris, founder of Jupiter Communications and Sudo.com. Why do you think he symbolizes that whole period?
Well, Josh is a great combination of a very intelligent man. He founded Jupiter, which was the first market research firm. And he realized that the internet was creating a lot of, you know, a lot of people were using the internet. There were a lot of eyeballs to be counted and that companies and advertisers would pay for that information to find out how many people were watching what and when. And so he created this market research firm, sold it for a grip of money, and then proceeded to move to New York and founded Sudo.com, which was a web radio and video streaming company. But he also started throwing wild, elaborate, eccentric parties in New York. And, of course, everything came crashing down, and he lost a lot of money, basically his entire fortune. And he sort of symbolizes to me somebody whose intelligence sort of built him up, but then he got clouded by dreams of grandeur. And, of course, from there, everything came crashing down for him.
And so fast forward a decade or so, where is Josh Harris now?
Now he's, I believe, living in Los Angeles, but as of 2 years ago, he was in Africa teaching basketball to a bunch of Ethiopian children. And I think he has perhaps my favorite trajectory of anyone from the dot-com era.
What about Sean Fanning? He's that college kid who turned the music industry on its ear when he developed Napster, the online music sharing site. Napster's still around, but it never quite topped its success during the late 1990s. Why was Napster so important to the dot-com period?
Well, I think Sean represents a few different things. One, he represents the kid in a bedroom with an idea, and he didn't really care about making money. He was a classic disruptor, and so he'd used technology to essentially show the music business that they were in trouble. They had to listen to their customers and their users and have a lot more respect for what they would be capable of doing with a computer and a web connection. He succeeded at doing that. I don't think he succeeded in creating a viable business. Napster was reinvented and reconfigured several times in the last decade, you know, hasn't ever really recovered to the point of something like an iTunes. But Sean was definitely a big disruptor, and I think he became a force to be reckoned with in terms of how to build technology that was easy to use and could really give users what they wanted, even if the companies didn't like the outcome.
Let me ask you about Julie Wainwright, because she seemed to have a hit with her website, Pets.com. It sold all sorts of things for pets. The company was doing so well at one point, it even bought an ad during the Super Bowl, which features a dog sock puppet singing and imploring pet owners not to leave them alone when they went out to buy pet supplies. Here it is.
If you leave me now, you'll take away the biggest part of me. Ooh, no, baby. Please don't go.
So, Stephen Leckert of Wired Magazine, what happened to Julie Wainwright and her Pets.com?
Well, as you may have guessed, it did not succeed, despite the beauty of that song right there. they dropped a lot of money on advertising, millions of dollars in 1 year. And it was important, I think, in the sense that they were one of the first dot-com companies to cross over into the mainstream and to have name brand recognition with everyone everywhere who wasn't even necessarily using the internet at the time. But unfortunately, in 2000, they were forced to liquidate all of their assets. Their stock dropped from $11 a share all the way down to 19 cents, and essentially their $300 million fortune completely evaporated.
In your Wired Magazine piece, you also looked at some companies that had good ideas but bad timing, like Newpedia, which was an online encyclopedia that preceded Wikipedia. Tell us about that one.
So Newpedia, which was founded by Jimmy Wales, he actually did found Wikipedia years later. Newpedia was a free online encyclopedia. Up until that time, you either bought a big stack of really beautiful embossed books, or you bought discs, plastic discs, and inserted them into your computer to get information. And Newpedia figured, well, why not give it away for free, put it online, and let anyone get it at any time? And that was a wonderful idea, but unfortunately, the way that Newpedia went about getting its content was hiring professional editors and then doing peer-reviewed content. So it was really time-consuming to get all of their writing done, and it was expensive to pay professionals. And of course, a few years later, Jimmy Wales figured out that with Wikipedia, you could tap a lot of free resources and labor online by, and this is a crazy idea, asking people to do it for free.
There were also a lot of companies, Stephen, back then that were looking to bring television to the internet. Why didn't that work then, when now we see such a push in that direction?
Broadband and bandwidth were expensive, and it was difficult, and we didn't have the pipes to get content to you in a timely fashion. So Yahoo invested $5.7 billion in broadcast.com. Unfortunately, it was slow. You would sit there, and you might try to be loading a video, and you'd see 3 seconds, and then it would keep loading, and then you'd see 2 seconds, and it would keep loading. And it was so frustrating that users just weren't quite ready to adopt it. But 5 years later, with YouTube, we found a website that could deliver up really quick clips and video. Better idea, better timing, I guess.
How far, how fast? With Web 2.0 and companies like Twitter and Facebook and YouTube these days, do you see the chance of another internet bubble bursting?
You know, I really hope not, mainly because it's just so painful to watch people lose so much money. But I think lessons have been learned. I think venture capitalists and investors want to see quicker results and numbers and aren't giving out huge sums of money to every 19-year-old who walks in the door with a great idea. So I don't think we'll see so much of a bubble. However, I do think that technology has this incredible ability to raise expectations and dreams. And I think that in the future, we're going to be seeing a lot of people investing in content delivery, things like television moving online with Hulu.com. I think everyone is starting to get that kind of excitement building, and I think we're going to see people investing a lot of money and a lot of time to try to figure out the best ways to do that. Whether it leads to a bubble, who knows?
Well, Stephen Leckert, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Stephen Leckert is a writer at Wired Magazine, helping us take a look back at the dot-com bubble boom and bust. In the new film, The Eclipse, Kieran Hines plays Michael Farr, a woodworking teacher in an Irish seaside town whose wife recently died of cancer, leaving him with 2 children and an embittered father-in-law. Michael is also a volunteer at the local Writers' Festival. One of his jobs is to shepherd guest speakers, including author Lena Morell, played by Eben Yaila. Lena writes about ghosts and the supernatural. It's a world about which she's very sensitive.
I don't know, man. probably some kind of a bird.
You think?
Yeah, or a heron, or maybe a fox.
It's freaky.
But Michael had been hearing and seeing things even before he met Lena. The quiet domesticity of his life as a grieving widower is continually interrupted by what might be a ghost. The paranormal becomes a bond between Lena and Michael through a series of catastrophic events that haunt them both throughout the festival. The Eclipse is co-written and directed by Irish playwright Conor McPherson, who's worked with Hines before when Hines starred in a Broadway production of McPherson's play The Seafarer. On a recent visit to Boston, they both sat down with Here and Now's Emiko Tamagawa. She began by asking Kieran Hines why he likes working with Conor McPherson.
I think I like the idea that I have no idea where Conor is coming from and that he's going to take me on a journey that's going to involve exploration, both emotionally and maybe philosophically. And during the course of the work together, we go down alleyways that may be dark with light at the end of it, and then we can have a truly shared experience.
Well, this particular project we're talking about, The Eclipse, this is a major role to entrust to Kieran. So what draws you to working with him? Connor?
It's a film about different people coming together, intersecting at a time in their lives where they're all perhaps struggling. And I needed someone at the heart of the film who was both dramatic and interesting at the same time without perhaps having to constantly be telling us what his problem was. And Kieran can present a person who may be struggling, and yet at the same time, Kieran as a human being has tremendous warmth. And I knew that if I could capture some of Kieran's real, undeniable personality of Kieran Hines as opposed to a character, yet then also allow him to bring all his formidable acting talent to a role, that it would really hold the whole thing together. And because he's practically in every scene of The Eclipse, I needed someone who was able to do many, many things. He fights physically, and he has responsibility for his children. He loves them. He also is angry with them at certain points. They love him. They're also sometimes dismayed with him.
There's a message from Grandad on the machine.
Yeah, what did he say?
I don't know, something about last night.
Oh, Jesus. I forgot. I said I'd bring him with us.
You better call him.
I'll call on him later. You all right with Fruit?
He gets to be a man with tremendous responsibility and yet to be a man who's totally lost.
I was thinking the one thing that about Michael Farr, the one sort of word that I would use in watching, he seems like a really decent guy.
Well, I think he is. I think he means no harm to anybody. I think he's, you know, he's a teacher. You know, his actual profession is a teacher. He's a woodwork teacher. And he's, you know, I don't know what you say, like a regular Joe. But when we pick him up in the story, he's just been unbalanced mentally and emotionally by the loss of a wife. I mean, I also think quietly, he's a man. He works with wood and stuff, but he has some other sensibility. I don't know quite what to put my finger on it, not sensitivity, but a sensibility, the idea that what he enjoys about other people is some kind of their truth. In writers, when he talks about the writing of other people, it's the essence of their truth or who they are, and I think that's the way he lives his life.
And in the middle of this story, there are all these little gothic elements that pop up. There's the ghost story that's there too. Can you talk about sort of how that popped into your story? Because that's not where you started.
No, and the original short story, which my friend, the playwright Billy Roach, had written, Billy wrote a story set against the backdrop of a literary festival where there is a man who's a teacher who volunteers at the festival and becomes obsessed with this writer who arrives. And it was my wife who actually suggested that if he were a widower, we would understand his struggle and his confusion very quickly. And once she suggested that to me, then I sort of realised, well, a way of showing his mental anguish, which is easy to do in a story because you can get inside his head very quickly in prose, but on film, to understand that he's struggling with loss and grief, I realised then that he's literally haunted. By then having it as a ghost story, it's really an exploration of a person's psychological struggle. So yes, there are ghosts, but the reason I think they seem so real is because we suspect perhaps that they're coming from within him as opposed to something which is coming from the beyond.
You really believe in ghosts, don't you?
Why? Have you seen one?
I don't know. I mean, can you see the ghost of someone who's still alive?
Maybe, if that person is close to death, then they might come to you and... Let's please not talk about this stuff.
No, I'm sorry.
You should get going.
Just wanted to backtrack and talk about the relationship that your character, Michael, has with this woman writer.
Connor didn't write, I don't think, directly about man sees beautiful woman writer falls in love. He has made Michael, who has read her books, and read because he's a reader. And that's what draws him to her, first of all, is the writing, because what he says, he's having visitations, and he has read her book and ghosts, and he's very interested in what... Just about the work, about what she sees. It's not like somebody hitting on somebody. It's like a very gentle kind of connection. In the end, they do form some kind of bond through the extremity of the situation.
What do you want people to take away from your film, Connor?
I want them to have gone through an emotional experience and to feel at the end that whatever happens, it will be the right thing. If they're going to be friends, that'll be good. If they're going to be lovers, that'll be great. And if they just see each other from time to time or even just write to each other, well, that'll be great too. Whatever way these people continue to be in each other's lives, it'll be the right way. And also to feel that Michael, as the central character in the film, through his horrific experiences that he has during the film, but also he has great positive experiences, that by the end of it, somehow he has perhaps breached a certain barrier within himself which will allow him to move forward with his family and his friends into a future which feels perhaps more open than it did at the beginning of the film, where he might have felt a little more hemmed in and unsure of his next move.
Would you say that Michael is an easy character to leave behind or not?
No, funny enough, I think about it because we shot this over a year ago, and yet because of however Connor has constructed the rhythm and movement, you get touched, immediately you watch it again, you go back into a place where you were, rather than even look at it analytically. There's still a moment of memory of little traces of residue of how much it cost that day or how light that day felt despite what is up there on the screen. And that's what you take away with you, the lightness against the little bits of residue.
That's Kieran Hines, the star, and Connor McPherson, the co-writer and director of the new film The Eclipse. They spoke with Here and Now's Emiko Tamagawa. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Jane Clayson. Robin Young returns on Monday. Have a great weekend, and please join us again here and now.